funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How long can a human body go without breathing? And what might we learn about real life far below the surface of the oceans if we could observe it without the distractions of scuba gear or submersible watercraft? As my guest today will tell us, a growing number of scientists are embracing free diving, swimming hundreds of feet down with no supplemental oxygen, as an unparalleled way to study marine creatures as they really behave. Freediving is also practiced by daredevil athletes who both train in the water and on dry land to hold their breath for several minutes on end and to keep their wits about them at depths that make it impossible to tell by looking which direction one is even swimming, up or down, right or left. Journalist James Nestor explores this thrilling subculture in his new book, Deep: Freediving, Renegade Science, and What the Ocean Tells Us About Ourselves. James, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much.
So tell us about how you started investigating free diving, I guess as part of an assignment, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I was sent by Outside Magazine to Greece in 2011 to cover something called the World Freediving Championship. Now, I had never seen anyone freedive before. I had never done it, didn't know much about the sport. And the first day I was there watching people swim down 300, 350 feet on a single breath of air, I mean, my mind was just absolutely blown. And that's what really sparked this book. I wanted to learn more about it and learn to see what freediving could be used for other than just competition.
Okay, so for those of us who have never been down deeper than the bottom of a swimming pool, and I would venture to guess that's a lot of us listening, talk about how different it is to dive once you get below a certain depth.
Well, what happens is your body starts acclimating to the water in some pretty amazing ways the second you put your face into water. All you need to do is put your face into your sink with some cooler water, and your heartbeat will lower up to about 30% less than its normal rate. Blood will begin shifting from your extremities into your core, and your mind will mellow out. Your thoughts will mellow. All these things allow you to conserve oxygen, which allow you to dive deeper and deeper. And the deeper you go, the more each of these reflexes kicks in. Eventually, some free divers at depths of around 300 feet have been recorded with heart rates of 7 beats per minute. According to scientists, that's impossible. A rate that low cannot support consciousness. You shouldn't be alive. And yet, deep in the water, these guys can live through it, and they come back just fine.
What does it take to be the sort of person who is willing to try 7 beats a minute and get down there? I mean, what did you learn about the psychology of people interested in freediving?
Well, there's two different types of freedivers, and I need to make this really clear, and I try to make it really clear in the book. There are competitive divers who are interested solely in going deeper than the next guy.
For the record.
And risking their lives doing it. And I thought that that world was interesting for a couple of weeks while I was in it, getting inside their heads. A lot of these guys seem to be literally sort of dumb and uninterested in the ocean. By dumb, I mean they get nitrogen narcosis at depth, so they don't even know where they are hundreds of feet down in the water, and they have to keep reminding themselves to stay conscious. A lot of these guys are actually very smart. They're doctors, they're, you know, physicists, so on and so forth. But this is the extreme sport they choose to pursue. Now, there are other freedivers who use freediving for research, and those are the guys I spent the last year and a half with. They're uncovering some really amazing things about our connection to the ocean and our connection to marine mammals.
It's remarkable how many things that we marvel at that marine mammals can do that turns out we can do too.
That's true. It turns out that dolphins and whales and seals all have the same mammalian dive reflexes. It turns out humans have them as well. So the same things that allow a whale to swim 10,000 feet down for 90 minutes at a time are the same things that allow the human body to swim down 300, 400 feet and not be crushed by the pressure. Equivalent pressures on land would either seriously injure us or kill us. But deep in the water, all of these reflexes start flipping on and allow us to stay at depth longer than we ever should be able to on land.
What happens to our lungs down there?
Well, it depends how deep you go. At around 30 feet, the volume of your lungs is going to be about halved. At 66 feet, it's going to be about a third of what they were at the surface. 99 feet, it's going to be about a quarter, and on and on. So you feel this happening, and this is one of the creepiest things about learning how to freedive. You feel your body changing with depth. Now, again, if these equivalent stresses were to happen to us on land, we probably wouldn't survive doing it. But in the water, our lungs, the capillaries in our lungs, begin to engorge with blood. Our body protects our lungs from collapsing under depth. And a lot of freedivers say, this is why we're meant to do this. We have these reflexes for a reason. It's not just a coincidence. Hmm.
So once you get down below, is it below 30 feet or so, rather than the ocean and gravity trying to pull you back up again, there's a point at which it starts to suck you right down.
That's exactly right. And that is also another very creepy and disarming thing about learning how to freedive. Not only are you feeling your lungs, like, go up towards your throat, but gravity reverses at around 35 feet. So at the beginning, you have to really fight to get deep in the water and swim down, keep swimming, exert a lot of energy. And at around 30 feet, you enter something called the zero gravity zone, where the water is neither pulling you to the surface or sucking you down. And past that point, at around 40 feet, you slowly start falling. You effortlessly fall into the ocean, and you will keep falling until you hit the seafloor.
Hmm. But then you have to think about how much energy it will take to get back up again.
Which is exactly what makes competitive freediving so dangerous, and is another reason why I have never done it and do not condone this sport. A lot of these guys obviously miscalculate the energy it's going to take to get back to the surface. It's like mountain climbing. You have to save 60% of your reserves for the trip back down. Well, if you miscalculate that in mountain climbing, maybe you can take a rest. Maybe you can hang out, eat a little food. You miscalculate that. In freediving, you're going to go unconscious beneath the ocean surface. And if someone's not there to pull you up, you're going to be dragged back down to the seafloor. You're going to die. So it's very dangerous stuff. And these guys are really pushing the limits of what the human body is able to do and, you know, how far people are willing to go to bust a record.
I was surprised. First of all, you witnessed a number of close calls, some just incredibly close, and you tell a story of how dangerous it can be to sort of drift off course, which wouldn't seem to be such a big deal.
Yeah, at the competition, a lot of competitive divers, I think, kind of delude themselves that this is a safe sport, that no one's ever going to get hurt, so on and so forth, but within the first hour of the first competition, people were coming up unconscious. They had blood on their faces. The next day, a guy came up technically dead, had to be resuscitated, and it just looked crazy to me. And yet there was something in the human body being able to dive down 300 feet, 400 feet, that absolutely enthralled me. I thought it was going to be completely impossible for someone to do that, and yet a lot of the guys who were making the dives were able to do it, and they came back up looking as though, you know, they were standing in the DMV. They looked almost bored by the fact that they just held their breath for 5 minutes and swam down 350 feet.
So you did some training and were astonished, first of all, at how quickly you were able to, I don't know if it's expand your lung capacity, but expand your capacity for holding your breath.
Yeah, a lot of freedivers have told me that freediving is a mental game. Well, for me, it was really a mental game because my introduction to it was by seeing all these guys not making their dives. So it took me months and months to get those visions out of my head,
sure,
to see the, you know, the bloody face of a Ukrainian diver resurfacing, get that out of my head and focus with another group of freedivers who have a much more sane and philosophical approach. And those are the people I hung out with for the vast majority of the book, and they taught me to listen to my body, know my limits, never push it. But it's amazing, and my ability to dive, I think, was hindered by first seeing the negative side of freediving. But anybody, even you, any listener out there, can right now hold your breath for 2 minutes, 2.5 minutes, no problem. If you don't have a serious ailment, anybody can do this. We just don't. We don't bother doing it because in most situations, we don't need to.
This is a terrible question, but I was thinking about drowning based on this book. Do people who drown, do they essentially lose consciousness first and then somehow they just never take another breath? Is that what typically happens?
They always lose consciousness first, yes.
So it's never that you breathe in a breath of water?
Well, you do after you... What happens is... I like how you prefaced that this is a terrible question. Well, I'm going to give you a terrible answer to it right now. What happens is you will black out, and you can stay in that blacked out state for about 2 minutes, completely unharmed. Your brain, which uses up about 30% of your body's oxygen, even though it's about 2% of your body's weight, is smart enough to turn itself off to conserve oxygen for the other organs in your body so that you can survive. But after those 2 minutes, your body will trigger something called terminal gasp, which is a last effort to breathe. If you're above the surface, no problem. You'll breathe in air. You'll be just fine. If you're below the surface, big problem.
Hmm. All right. So knowing all this, you work on expanding your lung capacity. What is that practice like?
It's basically a yoga practice. And again, these freedivers that I hung out with, that I learned freediving with, have a very holistic, almost a spiritual approach to this practice. And with them, this stuff, even though it doesn't sound safe, it's very safe because you're never diving alone. You're always listening to your body. So you start off by doing a bunch of what are basically yoga poses, just trying to stretch the musculature around your lungs. Because the human lungs, if you could take them out of your body and blow them up, they could blow up, you know, maybe 3 or 4 times the size that they are right now. But what keeps them contained is the musculature and the ribs around that chest area. So you learn how to stretch that. One free diver, the average male lung capacity is about 6 liters. There's a free diver who has now expanded his lungs to take in 12 liters of air.
Wow.
So that's how much you can do this with just some simple exercises.
And so let's talk about the divers that you came to really respect. These are people who are using this ability to go down without any supplemental gear, mostly to pay attention to what's happening and in some cases to actually scientifically document what's happening.
Exactly. What happens when you wear scuba or when you go down in a sub or if you send a robot down is animals are scared of you. They have very sensitive hearing. So even with a scuba tank, you're constantly inhaling air and you're exhaling air, and that creates bubbles. And so I've done a lot of scuba diving, and it's amazing, it's fantastic, I love it. But the one thing that always frustrated me about it is you approach a school of fish, and they all swim away. Mm-hmm. You approach a dolphin, it turns around, it's scared of you. One free diving instructor told me it's like going bird watching with a leaf blower on your and you don't realize that until you start free diving. And the first few dives, once I kind of figured this thing out and calmed my brain that everything was going to be okay, were just a real big paradigm shift for me to sit on the seafloor 30 feet down and not have fish go away from you, but have them welcome you into their schools, have dolphins come up to you and start trying to communicate with you. Hmm. Same thing with whales. And so a lot of very adept free divers are using this to document these interactions and try to study the communication patterns of dolphins and whales because no one's had access to them before except for these guys.
My guest is journalist James Nestor. We're talking about his new book, Deep, Freediving, Renegade Science, and What the Ocean Tells Us About Ourselves. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist James Nestor. We're talking about his new book, Deep: Free Diving, Renegade Science, and What the Ocean Tells Us About Ourselves. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So, James, you were mentioning that you can be down there and really up close and personal with marine animals in ways that people might not, almost might not believe are true. And I've read the book and I believe it. But can you talk about some of the things that you can do with these wild marine animals if you're not wearing scuba gear?
This stuff sounded so crazy to me when I first started talking to these freediving researchers that I didn't believe it myself. And then they started sending me photographs, and then they started sending me videos, and then they were telling me that no one else has this footage, and I checked it out, and it's true. And that's one of the reasons that I insisted to the publisher, I said, we have to include color photographs in this book, because this stuff just sounds too crazy. After that, I was able to join them on some expeditions and saw it for myself, and all of this stuff is true. All of it happens. I experienced it, and we have it on videotape, too. So it's basically the access that you're allotted is access you can't get by any other means, and it's immediate. With dolphins, they will come up, and this sounds crazy, but again, documented stuff. They will come up to freedivers and start communicating with them. Dolphins have first names, and they have last names, and this is documented fact. And dolphins will come up to freedivers and start repeating their first names and last names in these things called signature whistles over and over, because we are unlike any other humans that they have seen on the deck of a boat covered in scuba gear. They think we're of the ocean, just like them, another marine mammal, which in some ways we are.
Wow. And are you able to communicate back in some way?
One day, I hope. I mean, you can do little hand signs, you can do peace signs, you can play with them, you can swim down underneath them, and then they'll swim down underneath you. There's one free diver who has had sperm whale experiences. Sperm whales can grow about 60 feet, they weigh about 150,000 pounds, where they just played for hours under each other.
Explain how you play with a sperm whale.
Well, she's a very good free diver. She can hold her breath for about 7 minutes, dive down to about 200 feet. When I was with sperm whales, I didn't attempt anything like that. I was so completely freaked out and blown away by the experience, I just stayed near the surface and did some very short dives. But even at the surface, you know, a snorkeler can experience some of these things as well, and many have. When you're at the surface, you're not making any noise either. It really fascinates them when you start diving down deep just like they do, and they start following you. But one day, there's a number of researchers trying to figure out their communication code, and that's a lot of what I spend the book focusing on, is we know these animals are communicating, and they're probably communicating in a very sophisticated way, but no one's really spent too much time trying to crack that code. These guys are trying to do that right now.
I'll tell you what's astonishing, James, is of course there are researchers associated with universities. There are also people sort of doing this on their own.
Yes. What happens with a lot of the researchers at universities, and I worked with some of them, and they're great guys, is they're so encumbered by red tape. It takes them so many grant requests to get funding to go out and do this research. And then once they're doing it, they can't exactly tell their grad students to hop off a boat and start swimming with 60-foot whales who have 8-inch long teeth and are the world's largest predators. It just doesn't happen. So, unfortunately, they can't do a lot of this research. They use robots, they use scuba submarines, other machines that just aren't allowed to get that close to these animals. These freediving guys, I mean, they don't have to ask anyone. They grab a few Subway sandwiches, a few bottles of water, they head out in a boat, and they do whatever they want. So they're allowed immediate access to all of these animals, and they're just sort of catching up with how properly to record them so they can use all their data for scientific research. And hopefully they'll be collaborating with other scientists to really move this communication research forward.
Even getting down for 5 or 7 minutes at a time, which is astonishing, it's got to be a frustratingly short amount of time. Just as you get into the swing of things, you've got to hit the surface again, right?
It is and it isn't. You know, you're going up and down the water column very quick. If you think about scuba, you can go down to 100 feet and you can hang out there for, you know, maybe 30 minutes, and then it takes you about 7 minutes to come back up to the surface. Freedivers don't have that problem. You can descend and ascend as fast as you want. So when you have to grab a breath, you fly up to the surface. There's no worry about decompression sickness or anything like that. All of those things, all of those worries are attributed to scuba, to breathing compressed air. When you're just going off of one single breath of air, none of those things affect you. So you can go straight up to the surface, grab a breath of air, be right back down in a matter of seconds. And that's very different than scuba. And plus, a lot of animals really get a kick out of that because they just don't see people doing that too often.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Dennis in Arlington. Hey, Dennis.
Hi, how are you guys? Chris, love all your shows. This one is particularly close to home for me.
Hi,
James. Very much a pleasure. I had the opportunity. I taught scuba for Club Med in the Turks and Caicos Islands more than a couple of years ago and became casual friends with Umberto Pelizzari. And to say that that man is amazing is an understatement, to say the least. Also, I've played with Pepin and Tanya Streeter, actually, down there. My question for you, because you kind of touched on it a little bit, is shallow water blackout, having unfortunately had the opportunity to have to save more than a couple of people due to that, pulling them on the boat, explaining the physics of that. And well done on the book, and I'll take my answers off the air.
Thanks so much for your call.
Shallow water blackout is one of the many dangers of freediving. The pressures down in the water from 0 to 10 feet are the equivalent of going up in air 10,000 feet. And so this affects your body in a very significant way. What happens is your body begins trying to suck oxygen from your blood, but it's unable to because you've used up all your oxygen at depth. And so you create sort of a vacuum in your chest. And this usually ends up with a blackout, with going unconscious. What a lot of freedivers train to do is to expel their air at around 10 feet. This decreases that pressure, and allows you to come up to the surface very quickly and very safely. This is one of the many things you learn in a freediving course, and I would suggest before anyone try to dive down 100 feet or even dive down 10 feet, you take a freediving course and learn all of these safety measures. Shallow water blackout is also one of those things that happens to people when they push it too far. When you're spearfishing, you see a big fish, you go down there, you know you have to come up for air, but you just want to shoot this fish, and it affects a lot of spear fishermen. So it's something you have to always be conscious of. Never, ever dive alone. Always have someone watching you with every dive.
What did you learn about people who are still doing this today, or about the history of people who have done this over time?
Well, this is another unbelievable fact that I didn't believe until I really started researching it extensively. But I had heard reports from the 1500s of sailors saying pearl divers used to hold their breath for 15 minutes. These reports were from all over the world, from the South Pacific, from the Indian Ocean, from Greece, and all from separate travelers were saying the same thing over a course of 200 years, that all these guys were able to hold their breath for 15 minutes, go down, pick up some sponges or oysters or whatever, and come back to the surface totally fine. It wasn't until I later discovered that there's a freediver who now can hold his breath for 12 minutes and 30 seconds, and he's only been training for a couple of years. So if you grow up in a society where you're in the ocean every day and you're diving every day, it seems completely feasible that these quote-unquote fabricated reports from ancient sailors were actually true. I mean, if we're already holding our breath for 12 minutes and competitive divers have just been doing this stuff casually for 15, 20 years, then who knows what we're going to be doing in another 20 years.
I liked reading your experience with the Ama in Japan. Even though they were kind of not very interested in you, you were very interested in them.
They were the exact opposite of many of the competitive divers that I had met. Many of the competitive divers loved to talk about how deep they could go, how long they could hold their breath. Here, watch me do this. Not all of them. I'm just saying a few of them. There were some very sane ones, very cool people. After seeing the competition and after seeing some no-limits dives in which freedivers will attach themselves to machines to take them down even deeper, I watched a guy attempt an 800-foot dive on a single breath of air. after that experience, I said, that's it. No more competitive diving. I don't want to fall into that world. I went to Japan and met up with the AMA, who are probably the world's oldest continuous freediving culture. They've been doing this for 3,000 years. The women I met said they were the last in line. This is it. No one else is coming in. They were about 70 and 80 years old, have been diving every day for half of a century, and know the ocean better than anyone else. And they welcomed me in, at least for a day. They, you're right, they weren't the friendliest people in the world, but I kind of respected them for that. They were just doing their thing and didn't have too much interest having their pictures taken.
What are they going down there to bring up?
They go down to get food. Their relationship with the ocean, they said, the ocean is built in such a way that if you go down and just take what you can carry back up, the ocean will always provide for you. And they've been doing this that way for 3,000 years. In the last 100 years, we've discovered that you can trawl the seafloor, you can get big boats, you can hunt many large animals at the same time, and look what's happened to the oceans in that time. So it was very ironic to be out them with these 70, 80-year-old women diving, you know, grabbing a few handfuls of sea urchin, and in the background, you see these huge trawlers coming in with these enormous catches of fish. Seafood, the sea life around Japan is just decimated because they've been doing this for 50 years, whereas the AMA, who have this very loving relationship with the ocean, have been doing it for 3,000 years.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go on the phone now to Stephen in Denton. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
Good. Hey, I was wondering what kind of devices could you imagine we would use in the future to talk to animals, dolphins or whales or even other animals that are in the ocean, like gorillas or chimpanzees or something like that, like an app, or would it be like a duck call kind of a thing, or what?
There's a bunch of people currently developing a system that is a dolphin click translator, and they're working out of the University of Georgia, I believe, with a couple of really prominent dolphin scientists. And what this does is it takes the dolphin clicks and whistles and translates them to English words. And then so you could see possibly what the dolphin is saying. And then you could translate that back into dolphin clicks and whistles and have a two-way conversation. In all tests of this machine, it hasn't yet worked yet. The main problem is that the frequencies in which the human ear can hear is about up to 20,000 hertz. Dolphins can hear up to 150,000 hertz. We had no idea that they were communicating on such a broad span of frequencies until we recorded their clicks and looked at them through a spectrogram, and we realized we had been hearing just a sliver of what they were actually saying.
Wow.
So there's a lot of technology that needs to be developed. There are zero funds. No one's doing this. You know, there's no cure for hair loss down in the ocean, so there's not a lot of pharmaceutical companies too interested in checking out dolphin communication.
So you've got some people who want to do this research building their own submarines. This blows my mind, I have to tell you.
These guys were so frustrated by the lack of marine research, especially with sperm whales and dolphins, that they've created their own research organization, and they're just taking it on and doing it themselves. One of the main characters in the book is this guy named Fabrice Schnoller. He lives on an island about 400 miles off the coast of Madagascar, in other words, in the middle of nowhere.
Right.
This guy was sailing a boat around 6-7 years ago. He saw a pod of sperm whales, didn't know anything about them, got in the water, and his life was forever changed. Sold his company, dedicated his life to figuring this out. The whales surrounded him, they communicated with him, they oriented their bodies around him and welcomed him into the pod. The encounter lasted 3 hours. So he's the main guy pushing into this research. A lot of academic and institutional researchers are not too happy about this because he's accumulating so much data so quickly. And, you know, in 60 years, institutional researchers have done, in my opinion, not as much as they could do. And he's, in 3 years, Schnoller has collected more behavioral and click communication data on these animals than anyone in history.
So how does that work with a guy like Schnoller, who is ostensibly an amateur? I mean, are his data accepted by peer-reviewed journals? And how does it make its way into sort of the accepted annals of science?
I was just talking to a scientist about this yesterday. the problem with Schnoller is he's not too good at interpreting data, but he's very good at collecting it. So institutional scientists who can't get on a boat for 3 months at a time, who can't just leave their office and go swim with sperm whales every day, these guys are really good at interpreting data and using that data to understand things on a larger scope. But Schnoller is very good at getting data. So I'm trying to bridge these two groups and get these people to talk to one another. And so far, it's not working that well. Institutional researchers, at least the few that I've talked to, I know not everyone is like this, are really determined on defending their turf. They don't want an outsider coming in. So there's a big push-pull here. But luckily, there is some headway being made. The University of Paris has a few researchers who are now working with Schnoller. They're going to be publishing some peer-reviewed studies and some reports in the next couple of years.
It is interesting to think that there are at least some people out there trying to go back to being citizen scientists in the way that they were during the Enlightenment.
You think about it, and all across various technologies and industries, this is what's happening. I mean, even 30 years ago, there weren't any independent car makers. Well, now there's Tesla, and now there's a bunch of car makers around here in San Francisco who are developing these three-wheeled, incredible electric cars with gyroscopes underneath them because other car manufacturers weren't doing this stuff. The same thing is happening with marine mammal research. No one's doing this stuff. Technology's gotten a lot cheaper. Schnoller and all his friends buy stuff off of eBay, cobble together this equipment that 20 years ago would have cost $200,000. Today it costs a couple hundred bucks. So it's a perfect storm of everything that's swarming around right now, and I really hope there's going to be some progress in understanding these animals.
We're speaking this hour with journalist James Nestor about his new book, Deep: Free Diving, Renegade Science, and What the Ocean Tells Us About Ourselves. We will take more of your calls after the break. You can get on the line at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist James Nestor about his new book, Deep: Free Diving, Renegade Science, and What the Ocean Tells Us About Ourselves. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Send email to think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. We have on the phone now Roseanne. She's on the line in Richardson. Hi, Roseanne.
Hi there. I have a comment and a question.
Okay.
My comment is, and he touched on this a bit, but I lived in Italy for a few years, and there it's like a national sport. They're always covering record-breaking and that sort of thing, and why it's not as well-known here. And my other question is there a difference between men and women as they free dive?
Well, in Italy and in Greece, freediving, you're 100% right. It's a huge deal out there. It's a big sport. A lot of people do it. The water is much better for freediving. It's usually clear. It's usually warm. They also have been, it's part of their culture. They've been doing it for a long time. And a lot of competitive diving started in Italy and in Greece and in the Mediterranean around there. So why it hasn't picked up here, I'm not quite sure. I think it has something to do with how difficult it would be to hold a freediving competition in the waters off of Florida, for instance, if authorities knew what was really going on out there. I think it would be quickly shut down, having people come up unconscious and technically dead for a few minutes. So I think that has a lot to do with it. And I don't know if there's a lot of interest in it, at least not right now. Freediving, recreational diving, is the number one fastest growing water sport right now. So a lot of people are checking it out. But competitive diving, many people aren't getting into it, at least in the U.S. I don't know exactly why, but maybe that's a good thing. Related to your other question, women naturally have less lung capacity than men. The average woman has about 4 liters of air in their full lungs, whereas a man can hold up to 6 liters. So that impedes advancement in breath holding to a certain degree. At the same time, there are some women with that smaller lung capacity who go to incredible depths all the time.
What kind of safety measures are in place for competitive free divers?
Well, this is my answer here is going to touch on one of the points that you brought up in the last section. What they do is they dive along a rope, and attached to this rope is a tether that's attached with this piece of Velcro. And what this is meant to do is to keep you on course, to go in a straight line down, because a lot of these competitive free divers dive with their eyes closed. They are, nitrogen narcosis starts affecting their brain. They need a guide. But what happened at the competition I was at is the Velcro strap fell off of this guy's ankle. And so instead of diving straight down, he was diving at a 45-degree angle down. And when he opened his eyes at 260 feet, he saw nothing around him. He didn't even know which way was up. So he started swimming sideways, thinking that's where the surface was. So even though you have all of these safety measures, and a bunch of competitive divers repeatedly have told me, there's so many layers of safety, nothing can ever happen. Well, it happens all the time. And in November, unfortunately, a free diver died during a competition, in the middle of a competition.
You mentioned they dive with their eyes closed, and that's not simply to protect their eyes. It actually helps conserve that much more brain power.
That's exactly right. You have to, in free diving, every little thing. And so if you can just conserve a teeny bit more oxygen, you'll be able to dive a little bit deeper. And you'll be able to come up conscious.
I don't think I had an appreciation, James, for just how uncomfortable it is for scientists who go into really deep submersibles to do their work until I read your book.
Well, I wasn't privy to the fancy institutional submarines. I called the guys, they had no interest in talking to me. Actually, very few people ever get to ride in those things, and they just don't take them out that often.
Well, it's like going into space, right? I mean, it's expensive to send somebody down.
It's extremely expensive, and if they take you along for a ride, they'll take you down a couple hundred feet and take you back up. Mm-hmm. That's it. But I found a guy, a New Jersey man, who moved to Roatan, who built his own submersible. He had zero experience with this stuff. He majored in American studies in college, and just over the years, he built his own submarine, and he takes people down, anyone who wants to go. He'll take you down around 2,500 feet. And that's the guy I found and had to cruise around with. I wanted to see this depth. I wanted to experience what it would be like to be that deep in the ocean. It's something that, you know, a very slim percentage of people will ever see. And I was writing this book, and I figured I had to do it.
Tell us about your experience with bioluminescence.
Well, down past the depth at which sunlight penetrates, which is going to be about 3,000 feet in very clear water, but in less clear water, it can be as low as 40 feet, 50 feet, or 100 feet. So what animals do is they communicate. They will never see any sunlight, so they communicate with light. And the reason why they have such large eyes is to see this bioluminescence, which is the chemical creation of light. And they use it for communication. They use it for mating. So the only light these animals will see is the light they make themselves. And it just looks like the 4th of July down there all the time, 24 hours a day.
Were you, I guess initially you were like, oh, there's nothing going on here. And then, it sounds like a breathtaking experience to see that for the first time.
What you see down there is stuff that no human has ever seen and most scientists have never seen. This guy, Carl Stanley, has been doing these dives for 10, 15 years. He sees new stuff every time he goes down. If you were to dump a net in the ocean down to around 3,000 feet and pull it up, about half the animals in there, there's a good chance that half the animals in there will be unknown to science. So we were really going into an explored part of the Earth. And what's down there is absolutely more bizarre than anything you can imagine. There are fish cruising around with legs, There's fish that are swimming vertically instead of horizontally. There's sharks that are just sort of fumbling around. You know, looks don't matter when there's no light. And these things seem to know it because they're pretty ugly, but also completely fascinating. The sort of the high point or low point, as it were, to that trip was seeing a comb jellyfish, which was enormous, about 3 or 4 feet wide, trying to communicate with us with various different colored lights, all in unison. And this thing doesn't have a brain, doesn't have a nervous system, doesn't have a stomach, and yet it knows how to scoot around, find mates, feed, and it was trying to communicate. So that kind of says a lot about how much we don't know about consciousness and how all of that works. And so it was a pretty profound experience.
Well, here's a nice related question from Stephen, who says, the animal interaction you describe is amazing. What would you ask of or say to a dolphin, if able?
I would say it's getting better. More people are conscious of the problems in the ocean with that we're dumping pollutants in there, and it's causing dolphins many problems. And I would try to reassure this animal that there are people clued into how intelligent they are and the potential for communication, and hopefully we'll make communication soon enough. You know, it's interesting to know that a dolphin's brain is 10% larger than ours and in many ways more developed. These are not stupid animals. And they've had that brain size for about 25 million years longer than we've had ours. And that, to me, says something.
And there's no dolphin wars.
I'm not sure. I never saw any. I know that there's different gangs of dolphins, and they communicate with their own dialects, and they come up to each other and do this little sort of macho wrangling. But I hear the juvenile males are kind of nightmares, as with every species. They're very curious. They're pretty rugged. You've got to kind of beware of them. But I had nothing but very peaceful, amazing experiences with these animals. I mean, it just sounds like some new age dream I'm describing, but this stuff is real. It's happening. We have videotape. We have photographs of it, and it's pretty amazing.
So I don't know what your opinion was before, but I mean, what is your sense? I think if I could talk to a dolphin, I'd want to say, don't worry, I'm not from SeaWorld. What is your feeling about animals who are brought into captivity and perhaps by human standards treated very well, but still, if they have this intellect, they're being used in ways that I don't know whether they really get a say in their careers as performing animals.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, on one hand, their presence in a park is educating other people that these animals exist, that they're important, that they're very intelligent. At the same time, it's essentially a prison. I mean, it really is. To spend your life when you're used to being in an open ocean, boundless open ocean, to spend your life in a concrete pool probably wouldn't be too fun, just like it wouldn't be too fun living in a jail cell. So hopefully there's a lot more awareness that these animals are intelligent. In India, they just passed a law banning all marine parks because of from recent findings of the dolphin brain, dolphin intelligence. And I think that same thing is going to start happening in the U.S.
When you are free diving just to observe marine life, how do you manage thinking about what you're seeing and really being awed by it, and also have in the back of your mind, okay, I've got 40 seconds left before I have to hightail it up to the surface?
It's the hardest thing to figure out because you're so dazzled by everything down there, everything that's happening. But your body knows. Your body's not stupid. You know when it's time to go, and you just have to always remind yourself not to push it. When it's time to go, you go up to the surface no matter what's happening down there. And the longer you train yourself, the longer you can stay down, the more familiar you get with feeling your body's each and every reflex happening, and the more you know when it's time to get up and take another breath. This is why at the beginning of freediving, when you don't know all these reflexes, when you're not sure when it's really time to go up, you really have to be with an instructor and never dive alone. I just want to make that point very clear. And after that point, things really open up.
You experienced not quite vertigo, but a weird sense of a fear of the depth below you in the way that you would if you were like teetering on the edge of a mountaintop. Can you describe how that worked for you?
The first lesson I took was in Florida, right outside of Miami. And we went to a freshwater scuba training facility. It was actually in Tampa. It's right outside of Tampa. And the visibility in this water was about 20 feet. If you know anything about the ocean, about visibility, that's nothing. So we were going down to about 30 feet or so, to the point where you couldn't tell what was up, what was down. All directions looked exactly the same. And the first time I got to that depth, I remember just looking at the instructor who was down there with me, just thinking, like, what am I doing? This just seems so wrong. But you get over that. We were hanging onto a rope, and you just learn to acclimate yourself to those situations. It is pretty amazing, though. It's about the closest thing to interstellar travel as you can imagine, just being in this completely other world where there's no gravity. Everything has changed. And it took me a while to get comfortable with that, but after a while I managed to figure it out.
How do you stay in condition to do this so that if, you know, a year from now you take another big trip, you'll be ready to go?
You can do regular breath hold exercises. Before this interview, I was doing a few of them to calm myself down. You can also swim in a neighborhood pool or swim in a pool, the, you know, YWCA, whatever. So once you learn how to do it, your body really will acclimate very quickly. If I'm away from the water and away from freediving for 2-3 months, it takes me about a day to get back into it, and then I'm diving as well as I would if I had just continued on. So your body has a memory. It knows, like riding a bike. I'm very cliche, but it really is. You just instantly start turning on those switches, and you're able to get deep.
Is there no concern about the cumulative effects of missing out on oxygen for minutes at a time?
There has been numerous studies on this, and it has no negative effect on your brain. Your brain is only going to start dying off when you haven't had oxygen for more than 2 minutes. What happens if there is no feed of oxygen in your blood? That's when your brain is going to start dying off. And that's usually that time is about 2 minutes. So you can hold your breath and even go unconscious for 2 minutes. You're going to be completely fine. There's been repeated studies on this. So just no negative effects of that whatsoever.
All right, the last thing I want to ask you is your favorite place in the world to free dive.
Anywhere in the ocean.
Anywhere.
I have no favorites. they're all wonderful in their own ways.
The new book by journalist James Nestor is called Deep, Free Diving, Renegade Science, and What the Ocean Tells Us About Ourselves. James, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.